Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful rainy Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll be with you for the next hour, sharing things that are going on in and around the city, talking to you about some things going on around the country, and sharing a recipe with you. And, of course, I have a guest on later in the show that I'm so happy to have with me, Casey Barber. She is a food writer and cookbook author, and we're going to talk about her book, Classic Snacks Made from Scratch. So don't go anywhere. First, lots of things going on in the city, but let's talk about what happened last weekend. On Sunday, the People's Climate March. What a day. News reporters are saying 310,000, but if you actually ask the organizers, of course, they say it was more like 400,000 people. But the line went on for miles. The crowd went on for miles. And it was such a sight. Being a part of it was really a beautiful, beautiful day. I marched with the food contingencies section of the march. And right there at the front of the stage, there were some great musicians, drummers, dancers. There was a poet, rapper, food rap man named Professor Louis, who has an unbelievable rap poem that he shared with everybody that really connects all the dots. You have no idea when he starts, where he's going to go, but it goes on for at least 5 minutes. And he connects everything from where you shop to the farmer's market to how you eat to our health to the environment. It's really a beautiful journey, this little so I suggest you listen to it. I actually put a link from a recording he did on my website this week. So check it out. That's iegreen.com. This link to his monologue is just really beautiful. But the march was just enlivening. It made me cry. It just felt so good that so many people were standing up against corporations and against fossil fuels and against, you know, everything that is contributing to the heightened greenhouse gas emissions, and taking a stand and saying we need to turn this around and calling out to our world leaders to take this issue seriously. It's not up for discussion anymore. It's not like, does it exist, climate change? It is a fact, and it just felt great to be with so many different groups. And also what was so wonderful was this was an event that all different groups could get behind, whether they're students in universities, indigenous folks, you know, all different groups, you know, the Sierra Club and 350.org and Greenpeace and all the nonprofits that we all prescribe to. And everybody was unified with one clear, clear message that we need to change regulations and do what we need to do to develop renewable energy so that we can become not dependent on fossil fuels, and we need to do it now. And so it was just really a great day, I thank all of you that came out and participated with IE Green and Slow Food North Shore and everyone that came out with whatever group you were with. It was just spectacular. And, you know, people said, well, as always, what is it going to do? Is it going to make a change? And to have the next day to hear that the Rockefeller Foundation was going to divest in all fossil fuel companies was just huge. It just was a pat on our backs. Just made everybody who was out there feel like there's hope, because they will be a role model. They will show all these universities that have huge endowment funds that you can invest in renewable energy and still make your mark. But we need to develop it, and we need to develop it now. So that was all great. And then Tuesday night, I actually catered a socially responsible investing dinner party that I told many of you about, and that went really well. Also talking about ways that, you know, people not the foundations, but just regular people who have some money to invest can choose to invest with companies and mutual funds that do not participate in supporting fossil fuel companies and biotech companies and the kind of mega corporations that are ruining our planet. So that felt really good. Lots going on this weekend. Oh, let me first take a moment to say Lashana Tova and Happy New Year to all of you celebrating the new year. I know this goes, it started last night for Rosh Hashanah and will end next Saturday, October 4th, with a break fast for Yom Kippur. So I wish you all who are celebrating a happy, happy new year. Next weekend, or this coming weekend, September 27th, Long Island Naturally is having their annual environmental fair, and that is at Manor Farm in Huntington. Then the Fall Harvest and Potluck is happening up at Sylvia's Center Farm in Kinderhook, and this is their annual fundraising event. Actually, it's not a fundraising because it's free, except for a cooking class, which costs $5. So it's just a Fall Harvest and Potluck. So come out and bring some local seasonal dish that you prepare. Also September 27th and 28th, and then again the following weekend, October 2nd through the 5th, is the annual Long Island Fair at Old Bethpage Restoration Village. This Long Island Fair has been going on since the mid-1800s. I mean, this is a fair that has really, you know, been there for the community for over 100 years. So this is a really big event. It was moved at one point from Mineola to Old Bethpage Village, and it's been there for many years now. So that is, every day is, you know, different times, but they're basically all-day events. So come out to Old Bethpage Restoration Village for the Long Island Fair. On October 2nd, I am doing a cooking demo at the Floral Park Public Library. It is a free demo, so if you have been wanting to take a cooking class with me, this might be a nice time to come on out. October 2nd, also, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility is hosting an event called Weathering the Storm, Restoring Faith, Justice, and Resilience to Climate-Impacted Communities. And that will be at the Copacabana on West 47th Street. The Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility is a great organization, actually taking a different different tact on divesting. We're talking about divesting from corporations that are doing the wrong thing. They actually invest in some of these corporations that we don't like so that they can influence the voting from within the company. So that's an interesting take, and they've been successful with that approach. So, you know, I guess if you have enough money to really make an impact on those boards, it really can make a difference. So that they're a great organization, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. October 3rd, Slow Food USA is welcoming Carlo Petrini, who is the founder of Slow Food International, and Alice Waters, who we all know as the woman that brought the edible schoolyard and local consciousness to our country. She will be here in Brooklyn at Roberta's on noon on October 3rd, and they're celebrating a collaborative effort called the Silver Snail. So come out to that if there's still tickets available. I know it's a free event, but I don't know. I know you have to get tickets online. So you can find those if you Google slowfoodusa.org. You'll find out about that. October 4th, there's a documentary screening of Growing Farmers, and that is the Rural Root Film Festival at Queen's Library. Growing Farmers is a great documentary that was put out by the Peconic Land Trust. That's at 3 o'clock. October 9th is a Food Day celebration. I know Food Day is not until later in the month, but Farmingdale State College is celebrating on October 9th. There will be a on-site farmers market, food demos, tastings, presentations from local producers, farmers, educators, and food activists. I will be there doing a cooking demo and talking, so that is all day from 10 to 4. And then in the evening at Farmingdale, they have a sustainable garden there, and the sustainable garden would like to welcome you into their garden for a potluck and medicinal workshop, and that's at 5:30 on October 9th. October 10th, the New York City Food Forum workshop is happening up at CUNY School of Public Health, and that's Why Equity Matters to New York City and Our Food System. that's an all-day event from 9:30 to 3:00. And you can go onto the CUNY School of Public Health to find out more about that. October 11th is a global frackdown everywhere, and that is going to be a big, big event. People are gathering all around the country and possibly all around the world. But here on Long Island, we are joining together to ban fracking and also to stop the Port Ambrose liquefied site that they're trying to build off of the coast of New Jersey and Long Island. So that gathering will be at the Boardwalk and National Boulevard in Long Beach at 1 o'clock. Again, that's October 11th. That's a really important thing to get a lot of people out to, so please spread the word. October 14th, Slow Food North Shore is celebrating or continuing their food on film series with The Sturgeon Queen, which is a lovely documentary about the Russ and Daughters restaurant and cafe. They just opened a cafe, actually, down on the Lower East Side, which I've heard great things about. I haven't been there yet. But that's going to be at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington at 7:30. Following, we will actually have the film producer there, as well as a wonderful kosher dairy reception following, with all the delicious Jewish food that Russ and Daughters is famous for. October 15th, Edible Long Island's first annual anniversary party. That's going to be at the Harbor Club in Prime. That's in Huntington from 6 to 9. And Edible Long Island is the middle section of Long Island. Edible magazines are a great magazine and almost a movement at this point. And, of course, there's the Edible East End and there's Edible Brooklyn and Queens and New York. Well, we finally have Edible Long Island. And it's been 1 year now, so come out and celebrate with us at the Harbor Club at Prime in Huntington. And lastly is Terra Madre is coming up. That is the Slow Food International's huge conference and food celebration that takes place every other year in Turin, Italy. And that's from October 23rd to 27th. And I'm really excited to say that I will be going again this year and will bring back whatever I can from there to enliven the food movement here. I'd like to now share a recipe with you. Also, you can find out about all these events on my website at IE Green. So if you didn't catch them all, please check out the website. At parties this week, I made some stuffed mushrooms, and everybody loves them, so I thought I'd share them with you. How often do we get stuffed mushrooms at a party and they're just not great? Well, that's inexcusable. So stuffed mushrooms should be great, and these ones really are. So depending on whether you're having it as a sit-down appetizer or whether it's being a past hors d'oeuvre, you want to pick mushrooms that people can really, you know, pop in their mouth in one bite or two bites. So you don't want them to be too large, but you want to find nice, you know, size. And but keep in mind that they will shrink down a little bit as they cook. So you want 15, you know, mushroom caps that are bite size or a little larger, stems removed, and, you know, you clean off the stems. I wipe my mushrooms. You don't want to wash them in water because it can make them too soggy. So you want to just take a wet paper towel and really wipe the mushrooms well to clean them. Then you need one celery chopped, one onion chopped, 1/4 cup of chopped red pepper, 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic, 1/4 cup of butter or olive oil, 1/4 cup of red wine, 1 tablespoon tamari, 1/2 teaspoon thyme, 1/4 cup parsley, salt and pepper to taste, 1/2 cup of organic breadcrumbs. I use whole wheat ones, or you can use a combination of, 2 tablespoons chopped walnuts, and 2 tablespoons Parmesan cheese. And you start by sautéing the onion in olive oil or butter. You know, if these are going to be vegan, obviously you use butter, and you leave the Parmesan cheese out. But instead of Parmesan cheese, you can sprinkle a little nutritional yeast in there, and that will give you a little bit of that flavor, and it's also delicious. So after you sauté the onions for a few minutes, you're going to add the celery. Let that cook down for another 5 minutes or so, and then add the garlic, the peppers, and the chopped mushroom stems. And keep cooking that until the peppers are soft. Then you can add the walnuts, the parsley, and the 2 tablespoons of red wine. Continue cooking for a few more minutes, and then add the remaining ingredients. And taste it. Adjust the spices. and then stuff the mushroom caps, and that's it. You're going to bake it in an oven, 375, for about 20 minutes. And, of course, as always, let me know how you enjoy them. And I love feedback. So, again, you can send messages to me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. So now it's my pleasure to invite on my guest today, Casey Barber. She is a food writer, cookbook author, and recipe developer. Her book, Classic Snacks Made from Scratch, is really fun. I've enjoyed it a lot. She has written articles that have appeared in Gourmet Live, Better Homes and Gardens, iVillage, Ready Made, and Draft, as well as some other publications. And this book, Classic Snacks Made from Scratch, 70 Homemade Versions of Your Favorite Brand Name Treats, is really a fun book to get on board, and especially if you have kids who are begging you for some of those foods that you will never buy for them, this is an opportunity to actually make it a project at home. So, Casey, are you with us?
I'm here, Bhavani.
Ah, great. I couldn't hear you. Hi, how are you?
Sorry. I'm well. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, can you just give us a little background, like what inspired you to be a food writer and recipe developer? Is this something you always knew you wanted to do?
It was definitely not something I ever thought could be an actual job or career at all.
Really?
I was a writer. I always knew I would be a writer. And cooking for myself sort of took a back burner for those first formative years of my life, living in dorms and small apartments and, you know, getting by with canned food and pasta and, you know, everything that you buy on a student budget.
Uh-huh.
So my early recipes are horrible and embarrassing and definitely not anything that I would be eating today for the most part.
Although they make lovely stories. Casey, I've shared many times when I first started cooking, the first time I ever used my wok, I opened two cans of Veg-All and put them in my wok. You know
yes.
what Veg-All is?
Yes, exactly.
With lima beans and little square carrots, and that's what I knew of for vegetables. That's all I had.
Right.
That's what I grew up with in my house. So I understand completely.
I've written an embarrassing story about how I used to make this pasta in college that I thought was so chic, and it involved a can of black olives. Which, I mean, granted, I still sort of eat them as a guilty pleasure from time to time, but mm-hmm. it was nothing real that I consider now. But,
right.
you know, everyone starts somewhere and you keep going at it. And as I kept writing and moving through very low-paying editorial jobs in New York City, I would come home and cook for myself at the end of the night, and it just became this sort of relaxing stress relief zone out and just be in your own space type thing, and I really started enjoying it, as well as eating out in New York a lot and experiencing all the wonderful things that they have. And people started asking for recommendations and recipes, and being a writer, of course, I was more than happy to oblige and write things up for them. And my interest just grew and grew and grew until I decided to make it an actual part of my career, and now it's my entire career.
That's lovely. It's so wonderful to hear stories, especially for our young listeners, to know that if you just follow your passions, they lead to something.
It's
so
true.
Many people
I
you hear go to college for one thing and
interest.
End up doing something else. And what
yes.
they end up doing is what they did on the side while they were in college.
Yes, and I think that, you know, the value of a liberal arts education also plays into that, where you can be a good communicator in general, leads you down a number of career paths that you never thought could actually be such a niche thing that work.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is those niche things that so often do work. So you
yes.
never went to culinary school or had any formal training?
I never did go to culinary school. I thought about it, but I had already been to graduate school for journalism, and I think I have enough student loans
right,
to last
right.
me for a while.
Uh-huh.
So it seems to be working without a culinary degree. I'll keep going with this path.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it got to your book, Classic Snacks Made from Scratch, that's more like treat food. What inspired you to write about that?
Oh, well, it sort of falls into the same idea that you shouldn't discount ideas and hobbies and likes that might seem weird from a larger perspective, because I have always been an unapologetic junk food fan. Those, you know, no disrespect to people who now feed their kids much healthier things, but I grew up happily eating sugar wafers and pudding pops and watching Press Your Luck and The Price is Right and all that wonderful nostalgic Americana.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a soft spot for the Cheez-It. I always will. And my husband started challenging me to sort of make my own Whole Foods versions of these things. And it became this really fun puzzle to unlock, and how you could actually make a Cheez-It without preservatives, and how you could make a good Schumer bar that had natural strawberries in it instead of strawberry quick-smelling tasting things.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working on it as a side project and realized it could actually be a book. There's enough there out in the junk food world to make that happen.
Right. Right, but even the photographs, I mean, they're so beautiful, and they look so professional. Do you really think a home cook could, I mean, you are a home cook, so I guess it is possible to really make them come out looking like that.
I have seen pictures that people who have cooked from the book have sent me, and I'm so happy to see that they can make a Milano look like a Milano cookie just like I can, and they can make Peeps, and it's... You can do it. I mean, there are lots of people out there who can decorate a cake much better than I can, and they're also home cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the creativity level out there is really high.
Right, right. Yeah, well, you know, I tell people, I share with them all the time, I also never went to culinary school. I am self-taught, and, you know, and those challenges really, you know, those are the things that really become your inspiration. You know, you get... You know, your husband's challenge really inspired you to work at it, you know. And, you know, I've had inspiration where, you know, I'm in a restaurant and someone's eating something and it smells so good, but it's, you know, something I don't eat. It's chicken or meat or something. And I'm like, okay, I need to figure out that type of sauce. And then I go home and play
exactly.
with it until I come up with something that, you know, my husband is not a vegetarian, so very often it might be him that was eating the thing that tasted so good that he can taste it. And say, yeah, you got it. Or nope, it had more of this or more of that. And, you know, and I'll play with it.
It's always nice to have an impartial tester at home.
Yes, it is. It is. So can you share with us what a typical day might look like in the life of a food writer or photographer?
Yeah, it's never the same day. It changes depending on, you know, the assignments I have blocked out for the week. But it always... starts out early with a cup of coffee, that's
mm-hmm.
for sure. Sometimes two cups of coffee. And I'm a
woman after
media.
My own heart.
Oh, I'm actually very sad that I love fall. It really is my favorite season of the year. But it's just getting a little too cold for the cold brew coffee anymore. And it was a little sad to see that go away. But I'm back on a nice hot drip cup every morning.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So they say to be a truly productive person, you should not check your email first thing, but I can't help it. I'm obsessed with Instagram and social media, so I do that right away. And then either I will finish up a story that I had marinating from the night before, or I will head right down into the kitchen with my coffee to start making food to either finish up recipes or photograph for the day. The light in our house is much better in the morning, so even if I have to photograph a cocktail or a beer, I will usually be doing that around 8 or 9 a.m., which sounds
wow.
hilarious and weird, but as a photographer, you kind of go when the light is, and especially that our days are going to get shorter. I like to get those shots out of the way early.
Mm-hmm. So you photograph all your own recipes?
When people need me to photograph, yes, I definitely do. It's one of the things that I've worked on over the years, and I was also an art major in college, so it's come in handy in that sense of the whole educational process as well, that I never thought I would end up knowing exactly how to photograph a beer, but now I do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a whole other specific and unknown skill set I didn't know I had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, that's something that I actually have not really explored very much. You know how very often when you get married, you kind of fall into your little roles. And I, too, went to art school, and my bachelor's is an art major. And I took photography and was very capable. But over the years, as after I got married, my husband loved taking photographs. And, you know, you have to carry back then a big camera. And,
yeah.
You know, and he took on that role. And so I stopped photographing, you know, and you kind of just get rusty, like in anything. And so, you know, I am starting to photograph my food more now that people are saying, you must put it up on Instagram and all these things that I'm trying to participate in.
Oh, my gosh. As an art person, you would love Instagram. It's just, it's a visual storytelling device, and it's so much fun. It really combines, it hits all those points that I think you would be like me and be fascinated by. It's wonderful.
Great. Well, I will explore it more. Right now, it just becomes like another thing people are telling me I should do.
I know. That's the balance between enjoying it and depending on it and feeling limited and guilty if you're not there. You know, being a freelancer, again, everything is different, or every day is different, but I'm always trying to sort of connect in some way since I do work from home alone for the most part, you know, with
right.
Cass and a husband floating in and out of the picture from time to time.
Right.
But the beauty of being a freelancer is that I was never very productive in an office after lunchtime, so now my afternoons are sort of my step away from things for a while moment and walk the aisles of Target for inspiration and go to the grocery store, and then I come back, and I like to have quiet writing time at night while I watch trashy TV, and then I'll do that again at the end of the night and call it, and then trundle off to bed.
Right. So that's good. You can really, you know, honor your rhythms when you're working at home. Great. So you want to share with us some of the more fun and unusual projects you've worked on?
Oh, the book was really one of the more unusual projects that I've enjoyed working on. But I also had the opportunity earlier this year to collaborate with a friend and fellow cocktail enthusiast in Austin. Her name is Lara Nixon, and she is the owner and proprietor of a craft cocktail consulting company called Bad Dog Bar Craft. And
what
she
is it
put
called?
Out Bad Dog Bar Craft because she has an adorable and naughty dog named Penny. And inspired by Penny and a number of things, Lara put out a children's book, an ABC book called A is for Absinthe, a spirited book of ABCs. And again, going back to my art background, I illustrated the book for her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cute and really witty. And it's a tongue-in-cheek look at the bar industry for those of us who are around our age, who have young children, who, again, don't have 9-to-5 jobs, who aren't firemen or policemen or construction workers or the typical career paths you usually see in kids' books, but want to explain to their children what they do as a career, however off the beaten path it might be. So C is for cocktails, which you'll have when you're older. D is for dram. It makes cocktails much bolder, and so on and so forth. And it's a really adorable little book.
That's funny. Well, I'm going to go look it up and check it out.
Yeah, so that was, it wasn't photography, it wasn't recipe development, it wasn't writing, it was just really creative work, and I had a great time doing it.
Right. Sometimes it's fun to just change it up a little bit.
Definitely. I'd love to do more illustration again. It made me realize how much I loved that part of my life.
Uh-huh. Good. So during the week, do you find that you cook more or you go out to eat more?
It really, again, it depends on the week. This week is a very heavy recipe development week, so unfortunately, I end up eating a lot of what I develop. So this week is gluten-free desserts for a client, and then a lot of salads to offset that.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And gluten-free desserts have come a long way.
I have. I really love the idea of alternative flours just as a part of your regular cooking and baking repertoire.
Uh-huh.
And if they happen to be gluten-free, that's a wonderful, you know, cherry on top of your healthy sundae, as it were. So having projects like this is a fun opportunity for me to sort of play around and just get general inspiration as well as give the client what they want as well. So we've had some amazing almond flour brownies, which I'm on my last brownie of, and they went way too quickly, so I think they're officially a success.
Uh-huh.
And coupled with, I'm working on a feature for a new cookbook coming out that my very good friend Andrea Lynn wrote, which is a culinary exploration of Queens. And
of
that
what?
Will be up on, of Queens, the borough,
uh-huh.
The most ethnically and culinarily diverse borough in New York. And her cookbook is called Queens, a Culinary Passport, and I'm doing a feature for it. So I'm photographing a few recipes for my review. So in addition to all these gluten-free desserts, this week we are eating Peruvian chicken with cilantro sauce and Filipino pimento cheese and all these wonderfully exotic things alongside. So it's really, it's always an adventure here with what we're cooking and eating. And
mm-hmm.
then some weeks I just don't want to cook at all.
Yeah, I understand
I really
that.
Don't.
Too. Yeah, I understand that. But it's hard sometimes if you're committed to high quality, although it's easier in the city than out on the island where I live, but knowing where your ingredients come from. And do you focus
exactly.
on that? Do you focus on that in your books?
I do. I think that's the base of every good meal is finding good, well-sourced ingredients. And along the lines of gluten-free, I think it is getting easier for people across America to find those good ingredients. People are paying attention to what's stocked even in the everyday grocery store, even if you are not lucky enough to have a fairway down the street from you.
Mm-hmm.
I talk with people who test my recipes and ask them what they can find and they can't find, and it's nice to hear that people are able to acquire really good ingredients.
Right, right. And when in your book, you don't use any artificial colors or flavoring. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think it would have been much easier to make a Ritz cracker if I had allowed myself to use artificial butter flavoring, but that's not part of the rules of the game in my world. So Ritz crackers never made it in. That's how
uh-huh.
it goes.
Uh-huh. Do you need a mold for making the crackers, like your cheese nips that are in there?
The Cheez-Its, honestly, if you've got there's a fluted pastry cutter that you can find in your normal, you know, baking equipment section, or you can just use your pizza cutter or even a knife and
uh-huh.
and a ruler. Grab it from your kid's art stash. And plastic and stainless steel rulers are great for the kitchen. They're totally washable.
Mm-hmm.
And they make your Cheez-Its look really professional.
And how do you get that orange color? Is it paprika or?
No, you can just use orange cheddar, which is naturally colored with annatto, which is a seed. It's
uh-huh.
actually not an artificial color at all. Or, you know, if you'd rather not use annatto, just use the white cheddar and a tiny bit of turmeric. No more than maybe a quarter teaspoon, because it will start to impart its distinct flavor the more you add it.
Right.
But that's the color I used for my homemade cheese whiz in the book, is I add a tiny bit of turmeric to sort of boost that color to it.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, you want something. Have you ever used the natural artificial, not artificial, the natural food colorings?
You know, I never have. I just tend to sort of, I mean, I don't really dye Easter eggs, or I am not a fan of red velvet cake.
Mm-hmm.
So in my everyday life, I don't really gravitate toward them that much.
Right.
And
right.
Then, of course, there's always things like beets, which are the most beautiful natural dye in the world that you can always sub in a pinch.
Right. They are beautiful. That red-colored juice is just amazing.
It really is.
Let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the, you know, essential tools you have in the kitchen and, you know, and some other ideas you have on cookbooks. So don't go anywhere, everyone. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Casey Barber from Classic Snacks Made from Scratch. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Casey Barber. She is the author of Classic Snacks Made from Scratch. And, Casey, are you with me?
I am.
Great. So, I know when we were talking before, you had shared with me that your husband is a picky eater. As a food,
yeah.
As a chef, food writer, how do you deal with that? And do you have any suggestions for parents of picky eaters?
I feel like this is a worldwide epidemic, and there's always some member of the family who's a picky eater, no matter what the age group. And I'm not sure if it's better or worse to have an adult or a child picky eater, because everyone seems to be pretty willful, no matter what age you are. But in defense of my husband, we've been together for almost 15 years now, and his repertoire has grown considerably since the day we met. He still eats no seafood whatsoever, and it's not because of an allergy. It's just because he doesn't like it. But he will eat steak tartare now. He will eat caramelized onions now, which seems like a little thing, but it's actually a big deal. And I basically have had a tough love approach for a lot of it, where I say, well, this is what we have to eat this week. It's free food. It's in our house. If you don't like it, you're welcome to make something yourself. But, you know, five peanut butter sandwiches later, he starts to think that that chicken looks a little more appealing than it did on day one. So I'm already making enough food in this house. I think making two dinners is
out of the question.
More than generous in
right.
my case. So I've just taken that tack. Like, this is what's out there. We live in one of the greatest food hubs in America. Embrace it, dude. We're here.
Right.
And slowly but surely, he's come around on some things. We'll see what the next 15 years brings, and if he starts to embrace lobster rolls,
you'll be amazed.
We'll be amazed. Mayo is a very tough sell for him, which it is for a lot of people.
Mayo?
But mayo, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Even if it's good mayo.
And those that love it, love
topic.
It.
Yes, and I love it. I
right.
really do.
Right. So,
if it's called aioli, sometimes he eats it.
What was that?
If it's called aioli, sometimes he eats it.
It's amazing what names can do.
Exactly. He's like, well, I know there's garlic in that one, so that's good.
Uh-huh. So as someone who's cooking all the time, what would you consider some of your most essential tools that you would suggest to people to have that they might not have? I mean, like, obviously everyone needs a knife, a spatula, but, you know, beyond those things, what tools do you find that you use all the time?
There is a tool which I use constantly, and it is really simple. It is the mini food processor that Cuisinart makes, and it's really small. It's only 3 cups, and I have a wonderful large Magimix professional food processor, which is actually out on my counter right now, which can shred cheese in, you know, 5 seconds flat. But when you're cooking for two people, or even if you are just doing everyday things like grinding nuts or making salad dressings, having a small food processor around is infinitely more useful to me than lugging the big guy out from time to time.
You know, I am right with you on that. I have my little Braun mini food processor, and I use it, I mean, for just chopping garlic, chopping ginger.
Exactly.
You know, instead of grating it, I use it all the time.
You know, if you want to upgrade to the stainless steel version, I think it's maybe $60, but there's a plastic version which is $35 or $40, probably adjusted for inflation at this point. But it's very compact, it cleans up so easily, and it is a lifesaver. I recommend it so often when I'm doing recipes as a great kitchen tool, and you don't have to invest. I mean, I also own a Vitamix. I also love my Vitamix, but you don't have to invest in those big $100 worth of equipment sometimes
right.
to get an awesome result. And then you're going to be able to make so much more from scratch, and you're going to be so much happier in the end when you taste real ranch dressing.
Right.
Instead
Absolutely.
Of
like, I remember I hadn't harvested all my basil yet, but I wanted to make a little pesto. You know, and just really a little. I wanted to make an omelet, so I just needed like a couple tablespoons worth. You know, I just ran out to the garden, picked a little basil, came in. I, you know, have pre-toasted pine nuts that I'd be able to throw in. Just, I was able to whip together pesto in no time flat.
Yes.
With salad dressings, I do the same thing as you all the
Homemade
time.
Homemade nut butters, you can put everything in your nut butter that you never thought was possible. I love to add miso, different nuts, fresh grated citrus peels, and then, you know, as the weather gets colder, oh, there's nothing like nut butter on good bread in the morning with your coffee.
Right.
I subsist on that.
Right. So you make your own nut butters. I make a lot of nut sauces, you know, walnut sauce, cashew sauce, lots of that.
I love all of those.
Uh-huh.
My husband is actually allergic to tree nuts. That's the one thing he's allergic to, so he's never had the pleasure of a cashew, and it makes me so sad.
Uh-huh.
But,
yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure you've tried many different things.
That
would be another
slide.
Conversation. But there are some ways of, you know, trying to work on the allergy things, too.
Yes.
So where do you find that you usually shop? Do you belong to a CSA? Do you grow your own food? Or do you just, you know, go shopping frequently on an as-need basis?
I do go shopping way more than I think a normal person should ever go shopping because I'm, despite my many, many lists and organizational help things, like Evernote, I always forget something. There's always something I forget. But I am at the grocery store, I would say, at least 3 times a week, and it's very embarrassing. But I have an abandoned garden in the front of my house that I used to be really gung-ho about keeping up with. And over the past few years, it has just sort of become the nasturtium and herb plot because I just sort of abandoned it. It doesn't get enough sunlight is my real problem. Is nothing in my yard gets enough sunlight to truly grow a great vegetable. My carrots were very tiny. My radishes were non-existent. And my new theory is I never know what I'm going to be cooking from week to week. A CSA would half the time go to waste. I have a gorgeous farm stand that is less than a mile away from my house. I can actually jog there in 5 minutes if I wanted to. And I would rather give them my money and support their farm than spend hundreds of dollars on things that just aren't quite working out in my own yard or having a CSA delivered to my house.
Right, right.
That's my new sustainability policy around here. Instead of being frustrated that it's August and I have grown exactly 2 peppers, 1 carrot, and some parsley.
Uh-huh. I hear you. I know how much time it takes.
Sticking with it for now.
Working in the garden, you know, I spend so much time out there, and So a lot of times it's time I don't have, or, you know, all of a sudden I have to harvest all this basil, and I'm supposed to be somewhere soon, and, you know, if the basil doesn't get picked now, it's going to get too cold tonight, it's going to all turn yellow, and, you know, those kind of issues that you have if you have a garden.
I will say the herbs I grow, they get used frequently. I will probably never stop growing herbs, because even just yesterday it was so lovely to go out there and grab some oregano that I needed for a dish and have it right outside my door. But other larger vegetables, the kale has only been used to feed the neighborhood groundhog. He always would get to it before I had a chance to harvest it. And so I'm being wonderful to the rodents of our neighborhood, apparently.
Well,
but I don't get to reap the bounty.
And is that local farmers... farm stand organic?
Some is organic. Some is merely certified local and hasn't gone through the organic certification process. And,
but they're doing it sustainably. They're not spraying and things like that.
They're not spraying. And some of it, and everything is labeled. Some of it comes from other farms as part of the Jersey Fresh program that we have in our state. There's sort of a farm consortium to share the vegetables, and it's really nice to just have around, and they're my egg supplier half the time, and they are really lovely people. Richfield Farms in Clifton, New Jersey.
Absolutely. It does make sense, and then you have less waste, and waste is a real problem too. I mean, there's nothing worse than the
feeling
of throwing
food
out.
Nothing breaks my heart more than looking and seeing that my peach has grown a really bad kind of mold fuzz on it because I didn't have time to do something with it. It just, it's so sad to have to throw food into the compost that I never ate.
So this
is my way of cutting down on that and eating everything I want when I want it. Like, I really could eat peaches every day of my life, but I'm probably not going to get around to that fourth batch of squash for a while. So let's just buy lots of peaches and save the squash for when I actually need them for a recipe.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard that a few weeks ago I went out to harvest my peaches, and they had disappeared overnight. I have this beautiful peach tree, and it was covered with peaches, and in one night it was wiped out with the squirrels, I think.
Oh.
You know, I went online trying to figure
out
what to take all my peaches in one night. They said squirrels. It was so upsetting.
The squirrels eat my garlic. Here, they're total Jersey squirrels. No one believes me, but every time I've tried to plant garlic, I've watched the squirrels dig them up and eat them.
Really?
I think that this is the New Jersey way of the squirrel.
Could be. Can you share with us what your favorite recipe from your book is? They're all beautiful, but of the recipes that you developed in classic snacks made from scratch. What?
Since we've already discussed Cheez-Its ad infinitum from classic snacks, I will pick an alternate recipe because I really do love a good Cheez-It. But I would have to say the homemade Oreo is my second favorite recipe from the book. And it took me a while to sort of crack the code on a cookie that was crunchy and not cakey, because a lot of homemade ones just sort of end up being more of a softer cookie, and you've got to have that pull-apart crunch to it. But
And it has to hold that crunch being next to the cream in the middle.
Yes, which you definitely have got to be able to twist that cream. It's got to have that firmness. And I really feel like I've hit my platonic ideal with the Oreo. And I think the secret to giving it that really dark, deep chocolatiness is something I learned from Harold McGee, the great food scientist who had written a column in the New York Times a few years ago on baked soda, which is nothing more than baking soda that you bake at a low temperature in your oven for about an hour to sort of evaporate some of the moisture from the baking soda and make it a more concentrated alkaline ingredient. So that's the thing. If you are afraid to use lye when making your own pretzels, you can concentrate your baking soda, and it will give you that glossy, kind of almost metallic taste that you get. And you use that instead of baking soda in a regular recipe, and you're going to get more of that oomph when it interacts with the cocoa powder as well.
Wow, I've never heard that.
How cool is that?
That is really cool.
And
I love that.
So, you know, I just do a box at a time, and we make a lot of pretzels in our house because I love pretzels very much. And
uh-huh.
then you can just plop it in and boil your pretzels and go to town. I've never done a bagel with it, but I think I should now that I've been thinking about it.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Pretzel bagel. I'm going to make this happen.
Uh-huh. I'd
yeah.
love that. I am certainly going to give that a try. And so do you find that you use cookbooks a lot yourself, or do you go to the internet, or do you, you know, yeah, basically, what do you do? Do you use for your
well,
inspiration?
Well, I have this theory that food writers are the only people actually keeping the cookbook industry alive, because we always want to buy our friends' cookbooks and support them. But I do have a pretty big cookbook collection, and I do use it. Whenever I have the chance to cook for fun, I like to go to the wall of cookbooks and pick out something I haven't done before and give it a whirl.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been some pretty distressing surveys done recently about how a lot of people love to buy cookbooks and love to buy them as gifts but never actually cook from them. And, you know, why are we putting all this work into these cookbooks if no one's actually ever going to make this recipe? But I understand
uh-huh.
it's really easy when you're at the store to just look up on your phone, you know, I want to make paprikash for dinner, what goes into that kind of thing. But
mm-hmm.
I love my research library of cookbooks, and I do cook from them whenever
uh-huh.
I have the opportunity.
Yeah, I love mine too, and I you know, and I use them as inspiration. It isn't that often that I actually follow a recipe step by step.
Yes. That is also the tragedy, is that we always tend to make it our own, but
uh-huh.
the inspiration is always there.
Right. It really is. So we have time for one last question. And if you were thinking about the items in your refrigerator, what, or actually it could be your cupboard too, what would you consider the most underrated ingredient in your kitchen?
The most underrated ingredient in my kitchen, well, I don't know if I would call it underrated, because people do use it for traditional uses a lot of the time, but I am obsessed. I actually have opened my fridge to answer this question, by the way. I'm obsessed with maple syrup. I love it. I use it for so many things. It's my sweetener in my coffee.
Oh, it's my sweetener,
too. I mix it with my soda stream as a soda syrup instead of, you know, just using simple syrup in my iced tea in the summer, too. I love to put it in my homemade nut butters. If anywhere you want to put honey or brown sugar, try maple syrup. It's so earthy, and it's got those great minerals, and it just gives you that whole new flavor.
Uh-huh. That's great. I use it in when I make iced coffee. I don't drink my morning coffee is not sweetened, but you know, if I have iced coffee later in the day or an iced tea, maple syrup is great because it dissolves so well. You know, regular sugar doesn't dissolve unless you make a syrup of it. So, you know, maple syrup is the perfect answer for that.
And in cocktails, it's just divine.
Uh-huh.
A little bourbon and maple syrup were meant to go together, I think.
Cool. So before we say goodbye, can you share with everyone how they can get to your website and see what you're up to if they want to stay in touch?
Sure. Basically, all you need to remember is Good Food Stories. That is my Instagram handle, my Twitter handle, and my website is goodfoodstories.com. And you will be able to find me very frequently at any of those places.
Great. Well, thank you, Casey, so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. And keep doing what you do so beautifully and sharing it all with us.
Likewise, and keep eating well.
Thank you. And everybody out there who's been joining us, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week. Happy holiday, and I'll see you again next Thursday. Bye for now.